Hi, I'm Ali Hassan, host of CBC's Laugh Out Loud. Do you like to laugh? Because we're serving up big laughs each week. We feature comedians from across Canada. You might already be fans of some of them, and others might be new discoveries. We record emerging comedians and established pros in front of live audiences all across the country, and we promise that you'll be literally laughing out loud. You can find Laugh Out Loud on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The line you hear all the time is, oh, comedians aren't allowed to joke about anything these days. And yet, one of the most popular podcasts out right now is this crass, wild, live comedy show on YouTube that keeps getting more and more popular. Today on the show, how did Kill Tony become one of the biggest comedy podcasts around? I'm Al-Amin Abdul-Mahmoud. This is Commotion. So look, me personally, when I think about how podcasts sound, the words that come to mind are intimate, relaxed, conversational. But then there are podcasts that give this vibe.
I live in LA and it's tough. I can't say what I want to say. And this is the only, you give people a platform to do it right. It's funny. It's raw. You're not recording it. You can say anything on this show.
That is the voice of Howie Mandel. He's popping in for an appearance on the Kill Tony podcast, and he's not the only celebrity comedian show up there. If you're not familiar, let me tell you about Kill Tony. Kill Tony is a competitive comedy showcase, and it broadcasts live from this Austin club every Monday night for over a million viewers. It's grown and grown and grown, and now it is one of the most popular live comedy podcasts out there. And as you just heard, it is trying to sort of bill itself as the kind of show that prides itself on being a place where comics can be crass and nasty, and crass and as nasty as they want to be. Kill Tony's been running for over 10 years, but it seems to have entered this new realm of popularity. And to give you an idea of that popularity, this August, Kill Tony's going to host two shows at Madison Square Garden. Billy Joel plays there. Billy Joel and also Kill Tony. That's wild to me. Commotion regulars Matt Hard and Ali Hassan are here to tell us about Kill Tony. Matt, Ali, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, man.
Thank you, bud.
What's going on, y'all? Okay, let me start. Let's talk about this experience of Kill Tony, Matt. I'm going to start with you on this. For people who have not experienced what Kill Tony is, what would you see if you tune in every Monday?
So it's a Monday night thing, and it's a podcast. It's also live on YouTube, which is how I consume it because I like to see it. I'd see it more of as a live show. 200, 300 people put their names in a hat at this huge comedy club called The Mother. In Austin, mm-hmm. which is quickly becoming kind of like Seattle was for grunge for comedy. Mm. Now, if you get your name pulled, you are given 1 minute uninterrupted on stage to perform stand-up.
1 minute.
1 minute. So you're doing this in front of the host. His name is Tony Hinchcliffe. The reference to Kill Tony. And then he usually has some famous celebrity comedian guests. There you had Howie Mandel. He's had Roseanne Barr. He's had a lot of people have been on there. It's grown organically over these years to be, you know, just a curiosity on YouTube to this empire now.
The way you named Roseanne Barr second is wild to me. I want to come back to that in a moment.
Hey, I'm trying to speak to younger listeners.
No, yeah. Sure.
let's get away from the Billy Joel and the Roseanne Barr. Let's try to act like we know what's going
right,
on in the
right,
world.
Right. Yeah.
I remember Roseanne Barr. Okay, we're going to come back to that in a minute. Ali, look, you're a comic dude. 60 seconds, is that enough time to make an impression?
It's very, very challenging. Yeah. Very, very challenging. Sometimes if you have a weird look and you can lean into that immediately, that is like a great gift.
I have a weird look.
You have a weird look. You could do it. Yeah. You could do it. But you've got the public radio thing and you might want to be a little intimate first. And before you know it, meow. Meow is that's the bell. You're gone. You're gone once the meow comes.
Yeah, there's a meow that says your time's up.
Yeah.
Mike Birbiglia, for example, storyteller. Takes an hour to unfold his act. Not the kind of act you'd see on a
Kill
Tony stage.
No, this rules out sort of the storyteller. Although Mike Birbiglia, you can go back, and he also had a special called Thank God for Jokes, and he's a prolific joke teller. He could do it. But yes, you definitely, if you're storytelling, that's your style.
Yeah.
You don't want to, you know, shoehorn in a new style, be discovered, and then all of a sudden they're like, we want more of that. And you're like, I don't have more of that. I just have a minute of that.
Yeah, I think the challenge there is to do your set in a hyper-condensed version, really. Your best kind of in and out.
Yeah, the tightest version of my set is not 60 seconds. About 8 minutes, and so I can't.
It's a long time.
Possible. Yeah. It takes a minute for people to warm up to me. Absolutely. I totally get it, Matt. Comedy competition shows are not new, right? Yeah. Like Last Comic Standing debuted in 2003. You know what makes Kill Tony an interesting variation of this format?
Well, because and this is a corny line where it's like, well, they turn the camera on the audience, but they really do here. So that's what I really like about it is seeing what someone is going to do with this minute, which arguably might be the biggest minute of their life. You see people go up there and excel and sell out arenas and, you know, buy their mother a house and, you know, they're set for a long time because of the Kill Tony stamp is on them and they're just set for life, right? So are they prepared in that minute? Did they do the homework? Are they well seasoned? Are they just an interesting character? That minute-long format is just, to me, so fascinating because it cuts all the fat and it shows you, is this person a viable entertainer?
Ali, you've played all kinds of rooms, from large rooms to my cubicle. When you sort of
the trauma of your cubicle, something I shan't soon forget.
When you think about Kill Tony, what's the most interesting aspect of this format for you?
You know, so I watched it in the early days, hopeful that somebody was actually going to kill Tony. That's why I watched it. I was like, is Tony
Hinchcliffe, Hinchcliffe
who himself is quite the bully, and in many ways, I'm sure we're going to talk about this.
There's a despicable
ability that surrounds this man. So I was hoping he was going to be embarrassed in some way. Sad to say he wasn't. It was quite the opposite. And now I've come back to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, as somebody on Reddit said this, the bullied have risen. You know what I mean? He's the bully, but the bully. And I think Tony would probably say, yeah, that was the point. That was not the point. I will tell you that was not the point.
Yeah.
It was about mocking people, making fun of them and roasting them.
And it's history.
See, I disagree there. I think when you see that, because he's got what something as you, a comedian, would describe as the acerbic wit. He goes one way. It's always kind of mean and low. And I'm not a fan, to be honest. But I do think that there's no denying how quick he is when he does these roasts with random people.
He's in
and
his element.
And I don't think – yeah, and I don't think it's always mean-spirited unless it's someone that comes up and makes a mockery out of the profession of stand-up, who comes up and maybe their friends have said, oh, you're a free spirit, you're really funny, and then come up unprepared and crap on their career.
My memories of how it used to be was not that.
Right.
I feel what you're describing is what I see now. In fact, I watched somebody bomb.
Yeah.
And then they were like, you know that – 2 seconds where you did this. That was a fun moment. That was a fun moment.
Yeah.
That was arguably your biggest love. So encouraging and supportive. I'm like, what happened here?
Yeah.
You know, and I hate to love. Yeah, it's a hate to love situation, but I do enjoy it. I do enjoy this show, and I think I enjoy it despite Tony Hinchcliffe.
And let me just about Hinchcliffe. He's what we would call in wrestling a heel. A guy you're supposed to hate.
Actively a bad guy.
It's called Kill Tony because you're supposed to hate this guy. He's probably a sociopath. He's nuts.
We are not done talking about Tony Hinchcliffe. I want to come back to that in just a moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, I should just tell people who are listening at home that Ali and Matt are turning towards each other as they agree. Matt, just talking to your microphone when you do that.
Oh,
you
I'm know? Sorry. Yeah,
it's
yeah, yeah.
It's totally fine.
Matt, you see, a microphone is a product.
It's like I've done radio for a while.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Okay, I want to play you guys this clip. Listen to this.
I come from old money. My dad was that paperclip on Microsoft Word. I don't even need to be here tonight. Talking about how can I help you. For starters, he could have drove me to football practice. Drunk bastard. But that was dad. Nights like these, I always think about my grandpa, folks. When I was a kid, my grandpa used to always sit down, and he used to always give me the best advice. He used to always sit me down and go... That was grandpa, you know.
Okay, so what you just heard is 30 seconds of the comedian Casey Rocket performing on Kill Tony last year. That is half of Casey Rocket's set.
Yeah.
Matt, tell us about the impact that a successful Kill Tony appearance can have on somebody who's up and coming.
Sure. Full disclosure, I am Casey Rocket's number one fanboy. The crab is real, and he's
right.
coming.
I don't know what that means, but he's the crab.
They call him the crab. He rips around the stage like a crab.
Okay,
you
got
to see him to believe him.
Okay.
And he's like Ollie said, a guy who instantly could come on and have like a physical presence, right?
Oh, my God. He uses every inch of the stage in a crab walk and then walking back and forth and you're like, oh my God,
this is now a Casey Rocket podcast. So continue.
So Casey was at that time a guy recovering from being addicted to Robitussin,
okay,
living in his car, came up, did that set, and absolutely crushed it. Standing ovation from the audience. And he's now gone on to sell out arenas. He's got his own podcast. He's getting a Netflix thing is rumored to be happening.
Robitussin sponsorship.
Like he says, ain't no fuss when you're on the tuss. So he's like, he's a wild character that really succeeds in this format because he's all over the place. A minute is good and consumable. Yeah. But to see him take off like this, it's amazing. And that's why I watch the show, to see those moments of hope where guys like this just skyrocket.
So you see a moment like that, Ellie. You see like a moment, hey, this is somebody up and coming, and then this helps to make their career, pushes it to this next level. But then also you see these veteran comics who are hanging around Kill Tony. We talked about Harry Mandel earlier. What do you make of the idea that, you know, all these sort of top comics who show up on Kill Tony be like, this is a place where we get to say the thing that we want to say?
That's probably the most offensive thing about this show to me. I mean, you know, Cliff Nesteroff has been in this world before. I don't know if you've talked to him.
We've had Cliff Nesteroff on this show. Yeah.
Check out comedy historian Cliff Nesteroff and what he says about these people who are like, you can't say anything more. He's like, you sound foolish. You have forgotten your history. Lenny Bruce was not allowed in the country of England, banned from the country. Lenny Bruce went to prison multiple times, from stage, directly escorted into prison multiple times. I mean, you could not say things, okay?
Yeah.
Joan
Literally, you
couldn't
say
even
things.
Speak about her pregnancy.
Absolutely,
so the camera
yeah.
had to be tight on her, and it was too intimate to talk about she's pregnant. Now you can say anything. And Howie Mandel, of all people, saying, do you want to say the N-word in traffic? Is that important to you, Howie? You're not going to say it on Kill Tony either. You're still going to deep-six your career. Yeah. I don't know what that is. That is just Howie doing, like, Howie being like the crowd pleaser in that moment as well. I think, yes, there is an element of you could say whatever you want here and there are no repercussions, but that depends, you know, and it doesn't bother me the way people might think it does because I'm a CBC guy or these people are saying all these offensive things, but
sure.
I do believe in comedy, free speech. What I don't believe in as much, what I struggle with is like the last episode I watched, Tucker Carlson was a surprise guest. I'm like, what?
What
I
are
know
we doing
comedy
here?
Makes for strange bedfellows, but what is Tucker? He was at dinner with Joe Rogan.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Joe, there's things I love about you, but I can't
Joe Rogan's
believe.
The owner of the mothership. Which
yeah,
is,
so
which
he comes as a special guest.
Where this
they don't
comedy
have chairs.
Happens.
They don't have microphones for them. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I was just having dinner with Tucker Carlson. I'm like, why?
Well, I mean, I thought the same thing. And I thought we were coming on to talk about it. I said, how am I going to defend Tucker Carlson?
You don't
Joe
have
Rogan.
To. That
know,
is not a thing
I know, but
that you
I was just saying,
all.
Like, what a bad example for people to get into
sure.
this, to make it look like it's some right wing comedy
took
fest.
It 8 minutes for us to get to Joe Rogan and Tucker Carlson.
So, but it was, I think, just a smart move on Tucker's or Tucker and Joe's part, just to be like, hey, like, here we are talking about it. You know, we're by my club, let's go in. But when I watch Casey Rocket or a William Montgomery or the oddballs that I'm drawn to mostly on the show, I'm not someone who's very into political comedy. I'm not thinking about Tony Hinchcliffe. I'm not thinking about Joe Rogan. I'm thinking about that person on stage and what they're going to do with that opportunity.
You know why? Because you're a romantic. That
I am, maybe,
that
maybe.
Is,
but I'm also a cynic,
there's,
too.
There's value in saying this as well. After their minute set, they stay on stage for another five to eight sometimes. So it's actually, in a way, more than your 1 minute.
Okay.
Yeah. You get to dive into what's interesting about you and this kind of stuff.
We got maybe a minute left to talk about Tony Hinchcliffe. We actually also have to talk about the fact that he's the center of some controversy as well. A few years ago, he was called out for using Asian slurs on his set. He got dropped by his agent, lost some gigs as a result. I don't look at his career and go, this looks like a career that is slowing down, Ali. What do you make of this?
It's the quote unquote fake cancellations. Yeah, he's going to be canceled. You canceled upwards. I love that moment because I was always like, there's something I don't like about this guy, and I was like, boom, there it is. I was justified in not liking him. So I like that moment personally that it happened.
Yeah.
And I hate that there have been no repercussions on his career. For that.
Matt, I gotta say, I heard the clip of Tony Hinchcliffe using those slurs. I was like, oh, this. I don't have to redeem you, actually.
No,
I don't have to go out of my way to go like, oh, this guy's worth – there's nothing – to me, I gotta go, I don't think I want anything to do with this person.
Yeah.
But then yet this show is one of the most popular things out there.
Yeah, because again, like I said, it's not – he's just providing a platform for whatever happens up there – is going to happen.
Yeah.
You can't control what they're going to go say. So you're going to see far left comedy, far right comedy, and everything in between.
Okay, well, there's, I mean, I'm going to watch the show just so I can have an opinion on it based on having watched it. But in the meantime, Matt, Ali, thank you for your time. You guys are the best. Thank you so much.
Until I perform in your cubicle again, my friend.
Can't wait. The set this afternoon. All right. Matt Hart is a Toronto media personality and leader of the band The Russian Futurists. Ali Hassan is a comedian also based in Toronto, the host of Laugh Out Loud right here on CBC Radio. And if you must, you can catch Kill Tony tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern on YouTube.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Okay, we're back. My name is Alamin Abdul Mahmoud. This is Commotion. I think the Joker is one of the most iconic villains in superhero cinema. Some of the best actors we've ever had have played the Joker. Jack Nicholson, Heath Ledger, Joaquin Phoenix. Jared Leto has also played the Joker, but that is neither here nor there. Listen, filmmaker Vera Drew has given us her own take of the character with her film The People's Joker. She shot it guerrilla style, mostly in 5 days on this tiny budget. And she wasn't just a director. She was the star, the co-writer, the editor of the film. The People's Joker is a dark and wild and empathetic coming-of-age tale about a trans woman called Joker the Harlequin. Let me just play you some of the trailer.
Gotham City is nothing but neon biker gangs, leather freaks, and cross-dressers. Is that what you want? Come home!
No, I won't, Mom. I'm gonna be a comedian!
When I look back on my life, before going Jokeman to Harlequin, so to speak, I wasn't even sure I existed. It's like blurry, cracked mosaic of all these gender revelations.
You mean she's a he?
Also comes in rainbow for pride.
What's beautiful about it is that critics are saying it's one of the most compelling versions of the Joker to date. Abraham Josephine Reisman saw the film and is here to talk about it. Josie, welcome to Commotion.
Oh, it's so good to be here. Thank you.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so happy to have you. Listen, let's cut right to the chase. You love this movie, right? Tell me what you love about
it. I absolutely adored it. I basically thought I was done with superhero cinema, with the use of those tropes on film. Mm-hmm. And then I saw this. An editor reached out and said, do you want to see this movie? I'd heard about it. I watched the screener. It blew my mind. I watched it with my 17-year-old gender fluid nibbling, who thought it was probably the best superhero movie that they had seen.
Yeah.
Big fan.
We are going to get into all of the details of this film in a moment. Maybe you want to give a quick outline of what this film is about.
Sure. It's a trans coming of age story and an indictment of the comedy industry. Mm. And it uses superhero characters and settings from the Batman mythos in order to tell that story. It's not exactly a superhero movie insofar as there aren't really the narrative conventions of a superhero movie. It's not, there's no big fight at the end that is full of laser blasts and everything.
Yes.
It's really about Vera Drew's coming of age as a trans woman and her frustrations with how awful the comedy industry has become. There's the stand-in for SNL and the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater called the United Clown Bureau that is tyrannical and is the only licensed outlet, the only legal outlet for comedy in Gotham City, because comedy has been outlawed. So it's about this character who starts out being raised male and then gets into comedy, discovers that she's female. And I won't spoil the ending, but it involves a lot of destruction and self-revelation. And there's a musical number at the very end.
You got me a musical number, buddy. But let me ask you this. I don't look at the Joker and go, oh, this is clearly a perfect vehicle for a contemporary trans coming of age story. What makes a Joker a fit for that kind of storytelling?
Ask any queer or trans superhero addict who likes the Batman mythos, what they think of the Joker.
Yeah.
And virtually any of them, any of us, will tell you this is a queer-coded villain. You know, there's a lot of queer-coded villains in the history of fiction, people who are kind of louche or effeminate, but you don't quite pinpoint what their deal is. And the Joker has long occupied that zone. I mean, you have Mark Hamill as the Joker in this animated movie showing a little leg and pointing out a high-heeled toe. You have Heath Ledger dressing as a nurse in disguise in The Dark Knight. There's all these little drops that maybe the Joker doesn't so much mind dressing up as a woman, or maybe the Joker doesn't quite subscribe to your ideas of what gender is. Because the Joker exists outside of society. That's the whole idea. The Joker is rejecting society as a whole as a bad joke. And any trans person who has come out in the past few years can tell you that's a very relatable feeling of just going, this world doesn't make any sense, and I'm choosing to opt out of the norms.
So let me tell you a little bit about how The People's Joker got on my radar, because how this movie got made was quite remarkable. You know, Vera Drew shot it in mostly 5 days on this tiny budget. And then the night before its Midnight Madness screening, right here in Toronto, the Toronto International Film Festival, Vera gets a strongly worded letter from Warner Brothers' legal department. It was not a cease and desist letter, but it was a, hey, hold on a minute. We own this character, and you, when we think your movie doesn't quite follow
your
parody.
They said they didn't regard it as parody.
That's right.
That's the legal... The legal grounds that Vera is releasing this on are this is fair parody. Use and parody. And DC sent a letter saying, we don't regard this as parody, which is not a cease and desist, but it's a strongly worded thing.
So word of the letter gets around. The TIFF premiere goes ahead. And I'm like, the noise is coming out about how great this film is. And I secure a ticket to the next day screening. I'm like, I gotta go see this film. And what happens is Vera pulls the movie from the festival circuit going forward. There is not to be a second screening at TIFF. There's, in fact, not to be any other screenings. And this one sole screening ends up kind of becoming something, some stuff of legend, you know? And then now here we are 2 years later. This movie gets released in theaters. What are some of the things that stand out to you in her story of making it and also releasing this movie?
It's so gutsy. I mean, I don't have... Look, I used to make short videos for my old employer in New York Magazine. And fair use was always a terrifying thing that was dangling over us at all times, because it's a thin reed to stand on. It is not the easiest legal grounds for using, you know, licensed IP or copyrighted IP, I should say, and intellectual property. But Vera went and did it. I mean, it's one of the most guerrilla punk rock things you can imagine. I mean, taking on Warner Discovery, one of the largest entertainment corporations in history, and just saying, look, I understand this character better than you. I can make a movie that's better than the Joaquin Phoenix one or the upcoming Joaquin Phoenix sequel with Lady Gaga. You know, I can put my stake in the ground and people will love this thing so much that you can't kill it. And I think that's it's achieved that even if at some point DC or Warner Brothers, I should say, tries to take this thing down, it's already become enough of a grassroots hit that it will forever live on as a cult classic that you buy on DVD in some shady, you know, street corner in your local city.
I'll tell you that the narrative the next few days in TIFF was certainly that Warner Brothers was just the Goliath that is crushing the David here, right?
Like
the sort of like it was tough to root for Warner Brothers in this particular fight, especially given how beloved this movie was coming out of that soul Midnight Madness screen that they had. I got maybe about a minute left here. We've talked about how, you know, talked on the show about how tired people are with superhero movies for the last little while. You write that The People's Joker shows us a viable way forward. What is that way forward?
Personal and queer. And visually interesting. Those are the three tenets that everything has to follow if they're going to be, if you're going to make a successful superhero movie now. It has to be not just a generic boilerplate, why don't you just learn how to be a hero or have a found family? Like, we've done those two plots enough. We need to have something that's specific, that's personal to the creator or creators. You need to have something that's visually thrilling, which this movie is, because she shot it in 5 days in front of a green screen and then had more than 100 animators with very different styles put together the CGI. And it has to be queer. Superhero fiction is fundamentally queer, and there's a huge queer fan base for it. But it's been a one-way love story since forever because the superhero industrial complex just doesn't want to acknowledge queer people in any kind of substantive, gritty, or exciting way.
There's been so much sort of anticipation of Disney, which owns Marvel, sort of at least adding some queer storylines to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And as much as there's anticipation, there has also been this frustration because that moment doesn't seem to be coming because Disney is not the company that I look to imagine they're going to do that. You know what I mean?
No. I mean, you have ostensibly queer characters in the Marvel mythos.
Yeah.
But I would never expect a large corporation who makes movies that are about superheroes to do something as sexual, as personal, as traumatic as this movie, or as funny as this movie. They just have to have everything be focus committed.
Yeah.
And now you have this new shot across the bow saying Beautiful. There's another way to do it.
Well, Josie, I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much for being here. This was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Josie Reisman is a freelance reporter. Go read her review of The People's Joker. It's in Rolling Stone magazine. And that is it for the show today. If you got a minute, we're on Instagram. You can find us at CommotionCBC. Me, my name is Alamine Abdul Mahmoud. I'm going to be back in this chair tomorrow, and I'll see you then.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.